Good morning. Welcome once again to Bible class this morning and another lesson in our series on God's timeline through the Bible. As we get underway this morning, I know that we've got a lot of people out. This colds and flus and stuff and diseases, it's all running rampant. Just seems to be ravaging the assembly, and so the Adamses are out because of all of that stuff. And there's several others, and Mary's up in New York, right? I think. And so, that's okay. I mean, we still assemble this morning as the body of Christ, and as we always do, we recognize that whether one of those members are suffering, all the members suffer with it. If one of those members is honored, all the members rejoice with it. And so in this time of announcements, if there's anything that you'd like to make the assembly aware of or you want to let us know about, now's the time to do that. So, aha. I didn't think Edna came by herself. All right, any updates on anything? Is anything on Wesley that we... Okay. Well, if nothing else, we'll just get underway. And now please, would you open your Bibles to Numbers chapter 22? Since we were not here on Wednesday, we're picking up where we left off last time. Dealing with the Balaam-Balak incident. Instead of rereading what we've commonly gone over, I'm going to mention something that I haven't talked about at all before, but it's in keeping with what we're going to go over. I'm not going to go over it in detail, but I do want to at least acknowledge its presence here in this incident. So come down with me to verse 22. Verse 22, this is Balaam, this false prophet, on his way to Moab to meet up with Balak, the king of Moab. And you're probably familiar with this little story, but I do want to just mention something about it. So we'll just get it in our minds as we read through it, and we'll get on with it. Verse 22, and God's anger was kindled because he went, and the angel of the Lord stood in the way for an adversary against him. That's against Balaam. Now he was riding upon his ass, and his two servants were with him. And the ass saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way, and his sword drawn in his hand. And the ass turned aside out of the way and went into the field. And Balaam smote the ass to turn her into the way. But the angel of the Lord stood in a path of the vineyards, a wall being on this side and a wall on that side. And when the ass saw the angel of the Lord, she thrust herself under the wall and crushed Balaam's foot against the wall, and he smote her again. And the angel of the Lord went further and stood in a narrow place where there was no way to turn either to the right hand or to the left. And when the ass saw the angel of the Lord, she fell under Balaam, that is, she sat down. And Balaam's anger was kindled, and he smote the ass with a staff. And the Lord opened the mouth of the ass, and she said unto Balaam, What have I done unto thee that thou hast smitten me these three times? And again, amazingly, Balaam didn't, it doesn't say he fainted, it doesn't say he went screaming away and saying, This donkey is talking to me. He just simply replies. And Balaam said unto the ass, Because thou hast mocked me, I would there were a sword in mine hand, for now I would kill thee. And the ass said unto Balaam, Am not I thine ass, upon which thou hast ridden ever since I was thine unto this day? Was I ever wont to do so unto thee? And he say, Nay. Then the Lord opened the eyes of Balaam, and he saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way, and his sword drawn in his hand. And he bowed down his head and fell flat on his face. The angel of the Lord said unto him, Wherefore hast thou smitten thine ass these three times? Behold, I went out to withstand thee, because thy way is perverse before me. And the ass saw me and turned from me these three times. Unless she had turned from me, surely now I had slain thee and saved her alive. The idea of that, I think, is just fascinating. Surely now also I'd have slain thee and saved her alive. And Balaam said unto the angel of the Lord, I have sinned, for I knew not that thou stoodest in the way against me. Now therefore, if it displease thee, I will get me back again. And the angel of the Lord said unto Balaam, Go with the men, but only the word that I shall speak unto thee, that shall thou speak. So Balaam went with the princes of Balak. Well, all I'm after is that little vignette that we have there describing this incident with Balaam and the angel of the Lord and the ass. And so I'm going to tell you the reason why I want to just touch on that, and that's all we're going to do, based upon how we left things in our last lesson. So it will kind of dovetail together. All right, we're not going to do any special music this morning. And before we get ourselves underway, I'd like to ask, Luke, would you lead us in prayer, please? All right. Well, if I can keep from blowing my nose and sneezing and everything, hopefully we'll get through all this. In our last lesson, we've been giving, last Sunday, we spent really the entire two lessons going over some background material about the Balaam-Balak incident. We know the cast of characters that are involved in this. We've come to understand that we've got this king of Moab, Gentile king Balak. He becomes a picture of the man of sin. The other character is Balaam himself, which is Satan's own prophet. He's a false prophet. He's a counterfeit, Satan's chief false prophet among the nations. And God himself, those are the three main characters, and do the talking. But behind the scenes is, of course, Satan himself and Israel, and God's plan for Israel and purpose for Israel in repossessing the earth from the adversary and establishing his kingdom residence upon it. And one of the things we have done is we've given you a bit of an understanding on map-wise what's going on. Here in the book of Numbers, you've got Israel now gone through the time in which the spies were sent up to spy out the land. They were sent back. That generation dies off. And they now come up here ready to cross the Jordan River and go into the promised land, where the Canaanites are, and start clearing it out under Joshua and all those kinds of things. So there, what you've got right now is Israel is sitting on the east side or Transjordanian side of the Jordan River, just across from Jericho. You've got these nations, these Gentile nations, Ammon, Moab, Edom, Midian. There's another one up, Bashan is up north where Og was defeated, and all of this kind of business. And Israel's now poised. And what you've got is you've got this land that Satan has invested so much time and energy in defiling it and polluting it and stacking so much evil in there, that, and he knows that land is sacred to God, and so he's defiling it, and he's doing all of these things to try to pollute that land and thwart God from ever utilizing that land. And so these Canaanites come from the whole Mesopotamian or Assyrian area down in there, and now Israel stands there poised to get ready to go into the land. And they've got now the law rehearsed in their minds. They're going to be going in. They're going to go in under a fantastic leader, Joshua, and they're going to go in and start actually taking that land back and wiping out the Canaanites that are in there. So they sit there in the middle of some of the worst possible areas on this earth that they could ever be in. They have enemies everywhere. They are despised, they are hated, and these enemies want to destroy them. Now, they've fought a couple of fights and shown that God is going to fight for them. The next on the list to fight is the Moabites under Balak. And Balak is not only the king of the Moabites, but he's also a scaredy cat. He's a coward. And he's afraid, and he wants to save his own skin, and by doing so, he's going to try a different approach with Israel. He's going to call for somebody who is worldwide known, this prophet, this super prophet, from way up north there in Pethor. And he's going to have this prophet named Balaam come down and be his guy to try and thwart God's plan with Israel and Israel from ever being anything that God is going to be able to utilize to repossess this earth. And so that's kind of the stage that we have set so far, and we've dealt with some background material and that kind of thing. And this morning, I want to pick up on something that was actually asked at the end of our last lesson. I think Steve asked the question about Balaam's salvation. I realize there are those who could see it both ways. I understand there's some controversy around who Balaam is, because some will come along and say he's really saved. He seems like he's justified. He's being used by God as his own prophet. And he's just a godly man gone bad. Because you have Balaam using the word Jehovah when he talks about God. You have him saying, "I hope I die the death of the righteous." You have him saying things along those lines. And there's some things later on that make it so that I understand how you could realize that that's the case, but I think there's other things that we're going to look at that make you realize that's not the case. He's not justified, and that's my position. He's not saved. I believe he's an unjustified man. He's a false prophet. He's a very powerful one, but a man who's been involved in all of the idolatry amongst the Gentiles, that's how he's gotten his reputation. His fame and reputation and power comes from being and dealing in all of the Gentiles' pagan religious services, all of the abominations of the Gentile nations, and in connection with Satan and his purpose, this prophet Balaam has been exalted, so to speak, among all the nations. And actually, Balaam has been given some power by Satan to have some success in this area of blessing and cursing people in that area. But one of the things that I think needs to be at least touched on is what takes place here with this issue of Balaam and his donkey. And here, as we read through verses 23 and 5, I think this will help understanding who this guy is and really speak to his justification or not. And so this, As Balaam's on this his donkey, this donkey sees the angel of the Lord standing in the way with his sword drawn in his hand. And so because of that, that's why this donkey is going to turn out of the way. He sees that, and so he's going to get out of the way. Good idea. And this happens three times as we read it. And the third time, with no place to go, he's boxed in. He can't go right, or he can't avoid this angel. The donkey, of course, at one point he crushes Balaam's foot. I always thought that was interesting, because Balaam's going to be limping around now. Here's this super duper prophet, you know, and he's got all this power, and Well, it doesn't say he's a healer or anything, but you wonder, you look at him and say, you know, couldn't you do something about your own foot? But, you know, I don't know if those faith healers today do that. You know, it's kind of like, are they like doctors? Because doctors have to go to other doctors, right? Doctor, isn't there some law a doctor can't self-prescribe or something like that? I wonder if faith healers go to other faith healers to get their hair restored or eyesight back or whatever. Anyway, I'm being facetious. But this whole thing with Balaam's donkey finally got to the point, as he's boxed in here, he just sets down, or she does. She just sits down and refuses to go on. And if Balaam, what I want you to see is that this isn't just given as a nice little children's story to teach in Sunday school, but it's there so that you recognize, if Balaam was thinking clearly, if he was not driven by something other than, there's something driving him other than common sense, right? There has to be. First of all, this animal won't go where he wants to go. Then the animal crushes his foot. Then the animal speaks to him. If he was thinking, what I'm after is, there's got to be something else powerfully driving him other than the way, just common sense. And there is. And this is what I think you need to get a better appreciation for in everything we're doing here. Balaam is after money. That's what he's after. He's doing everything he's doing for his image, the power of his image, and for his income. That's what he's doing. And that can drive you nuts. In fact, that describes a majority of pastors and ministers in the church today. They're there for their image and their income. That's why the rise of mega churches has become such a big deal. And this is why denominationalism is such a big deal still to this day. There's whole infrastructure involved in that you may not even think about. There's 401ks and there's millions and millions of dollars. Do you realize how much land some of these denominations, how much real estate some of these denominations own? The Baptist Church itself, I think, is only rivaled by the Catholic Church. The Presbyterians, they buy massive amounts of land, and they have enormous incomes. These ministers who stand up there and teach, they give a Aesop fable type thing for 20 minutes at most sometimes, and that's pretty long. Those guys are making millions of dollars. It's a industry that has taken root, and there's a lot of money to make in it, and for a lot of them and what they're doing, it's really not a difficult job at all. All you got to do is be a people person. But what I'm after is, you need to get a really good sense that here all of this angel of the Lord, all of this with him and his she ass there, all this stuff, he's still driven on. It hasn't occurred to him, by everything that's happened to him, this might not be a good idea. And he is blinded by this. And that's one of the things that needs to be really appreciated. Of all people being this super-duper prophet, so to speak, he should be thinking, and not driven by his greed, he should have recognized something was seriously wrong. Animals don't talk like this at the time. I'm not saying, like I said, I believe animals did talk originally. And it could be that he remembered that, or something was still going on. I don't know, but he wasn't concerned too much about the fact that it talked. He was more concerned that he couldn't get it to move. And he wanted to get to his money hole. And so he should have, as a prophet, think of it, as a prophet, he should have seen this. Maybe you could excuse the donkey from turning away a couple times and the crushing of the foot, but when it comes to him speaking to him, her speaking to him, I keep putting her as a him, when it comes to her speaking to him, of all people, he's supposed to be a prophet. What do prophets deal with? signs. He should have seen this as a sign. There's no way he should have missed this as a sign to don't go where you're going. You're going the wrong way. But he was driven by greed so much that he didn't perceive that. And so the account tells us here that instead of thinking something might be wrong or that he was doing the wrong thing or going the wrong way, every time his donkey tried to avoid going forward, he beat her with anger. And so with Balaam's inability to see the insanity of what was going on and what he was doing and going to Balak, it was an insane thing to go down there and think that you can alter God's plan for Israel and his plan to repossess this earth. And that's something that, and I use that word insane. It was insane. And in a sense, at this point, have you ever seen somebody be so violent and with oftentimes with animals that you almost realize they're nuts, they're crazy, they're insane. They've gone in. Have you ever heard this expression? They were insane with anger. That's what he was at this point. And I'll show you that in a moment. It's not said here, but that's exactly what was going on. It was insanity to just keep on beating her. And every time something went wrong, that the donkey, he beat her with anger, and Balaam was unable to see the insanity of what he was doing in going to Balak because of the blindness of his greed, as verses 28 through 30 describe. And God miraculously made Balaam's donkey talk to him. And in doing that, this is the core issue of why he did this, is not sitting in Numbers so much as it's sitting in another portion of God's Word. There's another reason why I wanted to go over this morning and to do this little exercise. I have told you and tried to get across that next to the understanding of the five courses of punishment and the installments of the fifth course of punishment as the time schedule and timeline of God throughout His Word and throughout history, not seeing the dispensation of grace, but everything He's doing to repossess the earth. Next to that is an appreciation for this issue, the Balaam-Balak account issue. And this incident, we have shown you in various passages that it is as big as the crossing of the Red Sea when God led the children of Israel out of Egypt and they crossed the Red Sea and then he brought it back in and drowned the entire Egyptian army. All of that God continually sets before them goes together with this issue. It's crossing Egypt, Balaam, Balak. Crossing Egypt, Balaam, Balak. These two go together. And I'm waiting till the end of this to show you a kicker of why they go together. You'll probably get there long before we get to that. But what I want you to see is again, how important this is to be brought up in God's program with Israel, because when they deal with, we'll put our timeline up here, when they deal with things as they occur out in the final installment, they're going to have to remember, they're going to be dealing with a scenario and a situation and an incident that is absolutely parallel to what took place with Balaam and Balak. Only now it's going to take place with the Antichrist, the man of sin, and his false prophet. So they're going to have to be schooled on this. They're going to have to know some things about it, and that's why you find this coming up in Peter's epistle. Come over to 2 Peter. Hold your place there, put your little piece of paper or ribbon, but come over to 2 Peter. And chapter 2, following on the heels of 1 Peter, which now ups the progressive development of the epistles to the remnant of Israel, as Hebrews reorients them, and James comes along and provides the exhortations to them, And then 1 Peter comes along and gives them the doctrine that they're going to operate upon as intelligent sons when it comes to the sufferings that they're going to be going through. And 2 Peter now is going to come along and provide additional doctrine to all of that, and especially concerning what they're going to be facing now. It's almost like you can see Hebrews and James is kind of this side. Let me put my... they're kind of here, and as you go down through these now, they're out here, and of course so is the book of the Revelation. But all I'm after in all of that is that you're advancing on now into the Lord's day of wrath by the time you're here. So the false teachers and those who would seduce the nation of Israel is going to be a really big important issue right now. All of that is laid out beautifully, and it follows a progressive development beautifully. So come down here in 2 Peter chapter 2, where God has Peter deal with the situation of the false prophets that's going to try to allure the remnant of Israel. And pick it up at verse 12, and I only do this because we're going to we've been talking about some of this prophetically and things along those lines with the five courses of punishment. In verse 12, he says, "But these are the false prophets, as natural brute beasts, made to be taken and destroyed, speak evil of things that they understand not, and shall utterly perish in their own corruption." There's going to be a beastly nature that gets developed out there, and that follows Daniel's prophecy, and it follows what Daniel sets forth to add the great details to the time schedule as he looks out here and he sees those beasts arise. And there's no doubt that this terminology is so paralleling with what's going on with them, the brutish, beastly nature. Jude will pick up on this as well. And in verse 13 he says, "And shall receive the reward of unrighteousness as they that count it pleasure to riot in the daytime. Spots are they, and blemishes, sporting themselves with their own deceivings while they feast with you, having eyes full of adultery, and that cannot cease from sin, beguiling unstable souls, and heart they exercised with covetous practices, cursed children, which have forsaken the right way and are gone astray, following the way of Balaam," here it is, "the son of Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness." Man, I mean, he is a lover of money. And that describes some of the biggest TV preachers and radio, TV and radio preachers today. Those guys, I call them the plane club, because it seems like you know you've arrived when you can finally get your own Cessna plane. When you can lay down the millions of dollars and buy that plane and all of that kind of business, and they all have them. All those big shots have them. They don't fly commercial. They fly on their own planes. And then they'll tell you, well, that's just a sign of God blessing me. No, it's not. It's a sign of how good you are at duping Christians out of their money. And not even Christians. But anyway, this guy is nuts about money. And so that's what's driving him, who love the wages of unrighteousness. But here's verse 16. Look at verse 16. "But was rebuked for his iniquity, the dumb ass speaking with man's voice." Here's what I'm after. "Forbade the madness of the prophet." See that word, madness? This guy, to put the clinical description on him from that great psychologist Barney Fife, he was a nut. "Forbade the madness of the prophet." And he goes on to talk about these are wells without water. This is very parallel to what Jude will come along and say and add in an even further development. But what I'm after there is that Peter says he forbade the madness of the prophet. And so if you come back to Numbers 22, If you come back there, when you read down through that, you'll find where after all that takes place, then all of a sudden, in verse 31, the Lord opened the eyes of Balaam. And so now he woke up. Now he's woke. In verses 31 through 35. And the Lord opened his eyes. He sees the angel of the Lord standing in his way with his sword drawn in his hand. And Balaam now acknowledged his disobedience. And with this, God sent him on to Balak. But now God would use him. There's a turning point that takes place here. My understanding is that this is where God determines, I'm not going to destroy this guy. I have a plan. I'm going to be able to use this guy. Just like he could use some of the other unsaved Gentiles at certain times and be able to take Nebuchadnezzar and take Cyrus and some of these others and do exactly what he needed to get done. This was the case. At this point, he's going to use him for his own purpose and send him to Balak anyway, because there is something that he wants to get at and someone he wants to get at, which is Satan himself, who is behind all of this, and he's going to use it to his advantage of putting on display that nothing, not this nut prophet, not Balak, this cowardly king, not all of their plans to do that, nothing is going to thwart God's plan and purpose with the nation of Israel. And that's why I wanted to just mention that incident. I said at one point that we'd skip over it, but I think it's important to give you some insight into the man's mind, Balaam's mind, what he was set on, how driven he was by money, and how God turns this issue into using him for his plan and his purpose, as he's going to speak through him in ways that Balak is not at all prepared for. And so, again, I think that helps my understanding that this guy probably wasn't justified. You may be able to say, well, maybe he was still at that, but let's try to deal with this and maybe put this to rest, hopefully. Come over to, in which verse? 22.
I mean, it looks like that he's doing what God told him to do, but yet it also says his anger is kindled against him.
It's just, yeah, he's doing what he told him to do, but his anger is kindled against him. I think that's also indicative of the fact that he's going to be attempting to try to do the adversary's will.
So his motives are.
I think so. Yeah. Yeah, well, that's good, and that's a good thing to work on, spend some time with. All right, let's just look at one passage, just one or two, that we might be able to help us to understand the salvation justification issue of Balaam. Come over to Joshua chapter 13. To Joshua, and right after we get done with this, we're going to start looking at the messages. Joshua chapter 13. All right, when you're here in Joshua 13, Joshua has been rehearsing the history of Israel up to this point, and the land has begun to be conquered by this generation. And now the land is being divided up amongst the 12 tribes, and a short history is given here. And if you come down and look at Well, it's just a lot of the tribes getting their lands divided. Well, I don't think there's any reason to go back up. We'll just jump at the verse I'm after. There's a paragraph marker right there. Verse 22. It says, Balaam also, the son of Beor, the soothsayer, did the children of Israel slay with the sword among them that were slain by them. And then the border of the children of Reuben and Jordan, he goes on to talk about that. But that verse is inserted there. It's referring to what takes place later in, or back in Numbers, as later from 22 where we are. It takes place in Numbers 26 and following, where God told Israel to smite the Midianites for what they were doing at that time. And Balaam ends up dying with the Midianites against Israel. And that means that Balaam dies on the side of those who are directly opposed to God. And God looks upon him as if he's an abominable, uncircumcised Midianite and wants him dead among the Midianites. But I want you to note that little reference there in verse 22 that he's referred to as a soothsayer, a kakam or kasam in the Hebrew. And while that term can be used to apply to a real prophet, the fact is there's several times in the Hebrew language that there's several terms rather that can describe the abominations of someone who's involved in idol worship and all the things that are associated with that paganism and all those things along those lines. And in the way the term is used here, that falls into it. This soothsayer falls into that category. In fact, you find the same term translated another way, also though describing those involved in idolatry and ungodliness. Come back a little bit to Deuteronomy 18. Come back to Deuteronomy 18. And come down to verse 9. Deuteronomy 18 and verse 9. It says, when thou art come into the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, thou shalt not learn to do after the abominations of those nations. There shall not be found among you anyone that maketh his son or his daughter to pass through the fire, or that useth divination, or an observer of times, or an enchanter, or a witch, or a charmer, or a consulter with familiar spirits, or a wizard, or a necromancer. For all that do these things are an abomination unto the Lord, and because of these abominations, the Lord thy God doth drive them out from before thee. And he says, thou shalt be perfect with the Lord thy God. Okay, what I'm after there is, I wouldn't, in that context, think that God is talking about anybody that's justified. And yet God tells Israel that if they find anyone there described here in the land, they're to kill them. Because they are fully cooperating with Satan and his policy of evil. And you'll notice there in verse 10, you don't have the word soothsayer this time. It's the same Hebrew word, but it's translated divination. That's the same Hebrew word used by Joshua. Balaam is an individual involved in abominable things in God's sight. He's one who was involved in propagating Satan's policy of evil at this time. He was from the exact area where the whole Tower of Babel took place, and may have well been raised up to spread all that business throughout all the nations and influence the very nations in the land of Israel. This guy was as Eric and I have talked about, for all intents and purposes, he's a little Nimrod. He's that bad of a guy. So the point is, if, and this is my position, so, and it may not be yours, but Balak and all these other nations knew who this soothsayer Balaam was. And he has all the powerful reputation of being this super-duper prophet that could make, the only reason he was so powerful and so well known, he could make good on his prophecies. He was good at it. That at least the things he prophesied about, he could make happen what he prophesied. At least At least he could appear to do it, which is a big part of it, right? That's he could certainly give the impression that any time he blessed something, man, it got blessed. Anytime he cursed something, boy, did it ever get cursed. You know, and it's interesting that I would have thought, but then again, I guess I would have been naive to think it, that through the whole COVID period that we went through, if anything should have ripped the bandages off and pulled the what was it they did to the Wizard of Oz, pulled the curtain back and shown the phoniness of the charismatic movement and the phoniness of Pentecostalism, the phoniness of all of the faith healing that's going on, the faith healers and all their phony rottenness. I mean, you had guys who are supposed to be, how would these people think? I've given this ministry thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars, and now the head of this ministry gets up there and he says, I'm going to destroy COVID, and he blows a COVID, and so COVID's supposed to go away. Well, it never went away. It never did any of that, And if anything should have shown the charismatics and the Pentecostals, this stuff is just a bunch of hokum. This is ridiculous. You would think that it would have been that. But no. Now we got another revival going. Have you heard about this revival thing that's going on? And people are getting slain in the Holy Ghost, and they're speaking in tongues. That is one of the most ungodly things that is going on in this country right now. The Asbury or something like that. And it's not new. It's not new. The whole modern charismatic movement got started by some crazy, kooky, goofy garbage that was going on that they look at as one of their most sacred times of all in California at a place called Azusa Street, the Great Azusa Street Revival. Those people, that was an orgy. If you really know what was going on at Azusa Street, it was nothing to be proud of. And so you're going to see this resurgency again and again and again, and just the anemia of Christians to understand their Bible and be duped by all of this stuff. And heavens, it's not new. When I first started here, we were in the other building. Remember when the Ontario revival? There was one up in Ontario. And those people, they were seeing gold come down out of the rafters. And then they saw... angels, it was angel feathers. This is what I... Did you go up to Ontario? Yeah. Well, yeah, and I. So you know what I'm talking about. Yeah. I know that I had to laugh at the idea that the angel feathers were coming down, and I thought, you know what they've got up there? They've got a janitor. There's some little old janitor up there in his little janitor thing, and they say at the right time you just start throwing feathers down. And I thought, and it's just amazing what's going on out there. And so there's a market for it, and that's really what it is. It's great marketing. And so my understanding of this is that Balak was an unjustified man, a Gentile. And all the nations knew who he was. They knew his reputation. And he could at least appear to make good when he cursed somebody and blessed somebody. And isn't there, it just seems like in the back of my mind, isn't there one man, especially on this earth, that people go to and receive blessing and he puts his hand on them? And he wears a funny hat and all this. Yeah, it seems like I remember that. I don't know about him cursing anybody, but I'm telling you, it is amazing. And you wonder why Christians don't want anything to do with, you know, that or other people don't want anything to do with any of this. But anyway, that's my understanding. To put it to rest, as far as my position is concerned, I understand that this Balaam is a false prophet. He's not justified. He's not a believer. Even though God uses him and he uses the language and he uses the name of God and all of these kinds of things. Well, we got a little time left. Come back to Numbers now 22. And we're going to start to identify. Let's see if I want this. The four messages of Balaam. So again, verse 6. Chapter 24 and verse 6. I want to grab something out of here. Come now, therefore, I pray thee, cause me this people, for curse me this people, for they are too mighty for me. Peradventure I shall prevail. This is Balak wanting Balaam to do this. That we may smite them, and that may I drive them out of the land. Watch this. For I wot, what is another way for know, that he whom thou blessest is blessed, and he whom thou cursest is cursed. Balaam is the chief prophet among the Gentile nations in connection with Satan's desire, and he has the ability to at least appear to have the power to congregate. Remember, think for a moment. You're not dealing, when you're dealing with Balaam, you're not dealing with monotheism, right? You're not dealing with one God. That's Israel. Balaam deals with polytheism. He's a super-duper prophet among the Gentiles. How many gods did the Gentiles have? Holy moly, hundreds. Well, what he was able to do, and when you've got people going around after dumb idols, and I don't mean dumb in the sense that they're stupid, I mean dumb in the sense that they think they can talk but they can't. When Balaam was plying his trade, he was able to actually create the sensation or create the actual, however he did it, he could congregate those gods together. He could bring all hundreds of those gods together for anyone that Satan wanted blessed or favored, and depending upon what he wanted to get done in those nations. Those are very religious. When Paul came to Athens, he said, I see that in all things you're very superstitious. You can talk about the Romans, the Greeks, you can talk about the Medo-Persians, you can talk about the Babylonians, the Assyrians. All of them were steeped in this pagan religion. These weren't atheists. They determined crops. They determined everything on the gods, and they would go to the oracles, and they would check the oracles, and they'd check, you know, it's like going to see what Fauci says about COVID, and so it's always going to an oracle, and it's always going to the gods, and he was able to congregate them and bring them together for certain events, and to favor or bless those. And to curse others. And what I want to begin looking now is at these four messages that Balaam is supposed to speak concerning cursing Israel. But in each message, God instead has Balaam say the words he, God, wants him to say instead of Satan's words. And God, in every way, he has Balaam spit back in Balak's face the words that God wants said. And in doing so, he spits them right back in that other character behind the scenes, Satan's face. And again, I'm going to show you why, when we get done with this, you should be able to say, okay, I see the crossing of the Red Sea and how big of an event that was for Israel that needed to be remembered. Balaam, Balak, it's kind of down here. It's big, kind of needs to be remembered. When we get done with this, you're going to say, those have got to go together and be remembered together, just as they did, just as the prophet Micah puts them together and says, you've got to remember this. This is going to be important when you get out into that final stage of your program in that fifth installment of the fifth course of punishment. Well, so these messages now are going to begin taking place, and there's four of them in total, the four messages of Balaam. Balak, this king of the Moabites, this Gentile king, he only asked for three, but he gets more than he asked for. You need to be sure that you understand and appreciate what the reason for Balak having Balaam do this is, what it's really all about. Because on the surface, you've got this scaredy-cat king of Moab, Balak, trying to get this powerful prophet Balaam to curse Israel because he doesn't want to be destroyed like Og. He just saw what God did to Og, what Israel did to Og, king of Bashan. He also saw what God did to the Amorites and how they were defeated. This is a scaredy-cat king who wants to save his hide. Or to put it like Balak put it in verse 4, cast your eye back up there. Now shall this company lick up, I could just hear him, oh, now shall this company lick up all that are round about us as an ox licketh up the grass of the field. We're going to be like grass in an ox's mouth. So he's scared. I can almost hear his knees clacking together. But behind the scenes, Satan is working through this false prophet to bring together a confederacy of Gentile nations and their gods together to thwart God's plan and purpose with Israel to repossess the earth for God and to have his again, kingdom residence on it. So on three occasions, Balak has Balaam attempt to curse Israel. You know this very familiar, that each of those three times, God speaks through Balaam a message contrary to, opposite to, what Balak wanted. Because instead of cursing Israel, Balaam ends up pronouncing a blessing upon them. And you've got then is kind of three messages plus one. Three times Balaam comes back to Balak, gives a contrary message. The third time Balak sends Balaam away, after the third time he sends him away, and Balak doesn't ask for the fourth message. But a fourth one comes his way anyway. And so you've got God in four messages setting forth the fact that nothing is going to thwart his plan and purpose with the nation of Israel. We've talked about this before. Not the Gentiles' tumultuous opposition, not even Israel's own personal rebelliousness and contrariness. Neither one. In fact, you're going to hear in one of these messages one of the most unbelievable things God says about Israel, and your jaw would just hit the ground. And what? You surely can't mean that type thing. All right, let's just identify them, and that'll be enough for this first session. And by identifying, I mean we're just going to put them on the board. We really need to read through them, but I don't have time to do that. We might pick it up with that. Or just go through them as we go through them. We might do that. All right. The first one there is message number one is in Numbers 23 and verses 7 through 10. Numbers chapter 23, verses 7 through 10. You'll see where it says, and he, that's Balaam, he took up his parable and said, Balak, king of Moab, so forth and so on. So he's taking up his parable is he's going to now give his pronouncement. And it goes from verses 7, 8, 9, and 10. The second one begins there in verse 16. Actually, you could say up there in verse 14, there's a paragraph marker, but from verse 16 through 24. Numbers chapter 23, verses 16 through 24 is the second message. Then when you get down to chapter 24, you have the third message coming from, actually, it commences in verse 3, and Balaam took up his parable, but I'm going to include verse 1 in that, so it's going to be Numbers 24, verses 1 through 9 is the fourth message, and third message, and those are the only three that he asked for, that Balak asked for. But then he gets this fourth one, and it also is in Numbers 24, and It begins there in verse 15, but in fact, let's say it's verse 14, because again, in verse 15, you have a paragraph marker, I know, and it says he took up his parable, I know that, but you really need verse 14. And now, behold, I go unto my people, come therefore, I will advertise thee what this people shall do to thy people in the latter days. And by the way, the word advertise there is, what else does advertise mean other than advertising? If I will advertise thee. No. I checked this out. It's been a long, long time, but when I first got into the King James, understanding the accuracy of the King James Bible, this was one of the words that puzzled me. And one day I was in my study and I was having to replace a battery. And it was one of those little thin circle batteries like you have in hearing devices and things along those lines. And as I had it turned over, and of course they put these in packages that it takes a blowtorch to get the thing out. And I'm trying to get this thing undone, this blister pack thing. And I noticed that on the back of it, it has, of course, there's corrosiveness in that and everything. And it had messages in English and I think in Spanish and in French. And I think it was in, boy, Helen should be here. She'd tell me right now. But in one of those languages, I noticed that what it was saying in English, it said warning. In the other language, it said advertisement. It means a warning. I'm warning you. And you can have fun with understanding why I advertise you is a better word than warning. You'll have some fun finding that out. But all I'm after there is the accuracy. But anyway, so he says, I will advertise thee what this people, I'm going to warn you what this people shall do unto thy people. And then he took up his parable. So in this fourth one, we can say verse 14. So the fourth message is Numbers 24, verses 14 and through 24. There's one one verse left, I think, nearly to the end of the chapter. You ought to just 25. All right, so that's at least gets the four messages on the board. And we're out of time for the first session, so I think we'll stop right there. But all this is just pointing your finger and saying, there's one, there's two, there's three, there's four. When we come back, we're going to start talking about the nature of these, and then we're going to briefly look at each one of them, at least to be able to put our finger on what each one is about. And what's fascinating is, there's a progressive development to those. They're not randomly given. Two of them go together, and other two of them go together. And it's going to be fascinating to see that. But like I say, and then we'll have a big reveal at the end of it that hopefully will be very impressive to see these things need to be understood clearly. All right, we'll stop right there, and we'll take a break. I think there's coffee in the back, and we'll pick it up next time.